So, brethren, let's turn to Numbers chapter 12. I want to begin by looking at this story, Numbers chapter 12. And it's a story that everything around of it has fascinated me for a long time. I don't think I've ever given a message on it, but it's something that I can remember as far back as when I was in my early 20s, thinking about this and just being amazed at the story that God tells us here through Moses and Moses's life and what there is to learn in that for each and every one of us. So here we'll begin in Numbers chapter 12, verse 1. It says, "Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman." And in verse 2 it says, "So they said, 'Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also?' And the Lord heard it." You know, of course, what Miriam and Aaron spoke here was true, right? Miriam was called a prophetess of God. And of course, Aaron was the high priest and had been spoken through as well. But, you know, you see here that they began to think that they were in a more high station than they might really have been, especially towards God. And it's interesting, you know, we'll talk about many things, but, you know, this verse ends with, "The Lord heard it," right? And of course, the Lord hears everything. But the implication here is we see is that what the Lord heard, he didn't really appreciate. He didn't really appreciate what Miriam and Aaron were doing. You know, and again, like I said, many lessons we can learn here. But, you know, Miriam and Aaron were the older siblings. Moses was their, you know, little brother. And, you know, they might have been kind of protective, kind of as older siblings can be, you know, pretty hard on him, thinking that he hadn't done right. But then in verse 3, we see this very interesting thing that we'll look at. It says, "Now the man Moses was very humble, more than all men who were on the face of the earth." And it goes on in verse 4, it says, "Suddenly the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, 'Come out here, you three.'" Right? You know, again, these are brothers and sisters. So, you know, very apropos that the father comes and says, "Yeah, you're having a little sibling, argument. Come out here and I'll deal with it as your parent." It says, "So come out, you three, to the tabernacle of meeting." So the three came out. "Then the Lord came down in the pillar of the cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle and called Aaron and Miriam." So he was pretty clear here. He said, "You three come out, but then you two come closer, right? I want to talk directly to you two." So it goes on, and they both went forward. And you can only imagine what they're thinking here. You know, who knows? Maybe they're like, "Yeah, we got him. We got Moses. Like, God's going to say, 'Good job. I wasn't sure until you came out and criticized him, but now I'm sure. So you have him.'" But that's not what he does here. In verse 6, he says, "Then he said, 'Hear now my words,'" right? And I'm sure they're listening. So it's kind of a emphasis. "You better really listen to what I'm about to say." It says, "If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak to him in a dream." You know, implying that what he had been doing with Miriam and Aaron was he had been speaking to them through dreams, you know, calling that they had been called prophets and prophetesses. And he's saying, there, you know, there might be others, and I always talk to them through a vision, through a dream. He says in verse 7, "But not so my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house, and I speak to him face to face, even plainly and not in dark sayings. And he sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses?" You know, God is making very clear to Miriam and Aaron that in his mind, they're not equal to Moses, his servant. You know, that they're not on the same level of authority. They're not at the same level of closeness with God, right? God says, "I talk to you in dreams and visions and in dark sayings, but with Moses, I speak very plainly, face to face, so much that he even sees my form, my very form." You know, and were they ever unclear about the pecking order at this point? It becomes very clear where God sees them in relation to Moses. And that they have no standing to complain about Moses, right? We don't know the story. We know a few things here. We know that they complain about Moses' marriage to this Ethiopian woman, but we really don't have any other details about who this is. You know, we know that at some point he had another wife, Zipporah, but we aren't given any details about, you know, how Moses came and married this Ethiopian woman, exactly when it was, where was Zipporah at this time. We just don't know. You know, it doesn't say that. You can go to Josephus and some of the other, you know, non-biblical books that claim to be from around this time, and they give some details, and maybe it's true, maybe it's not. But, you know, it's interesting here because, as often happens in the Bible, God doesn't give us all the details. He doesn't, you know, in some ways distract us from his main point, his main focus. You know, here he said instead focuses on a very clear spiritual lesson that we can learn and doesn't distract with other details, right? We don't get to decide whether Miriam and Aaron might have been right about this Ethiopian woman. God here is very clear that he didn't think it was a problem. If he would have, he would have gone directly to Moses and talked to him, as he says clearly, right? And we see other times that God talked to Moses in this clear way, even when Moses might have not been doing exactly what God expected. And so continuing on in verse 9, it says, "So the anger of the Lord was aroused against them, and he departed. And when the cloud departed from above the tabernacle, suddenly Miriam became leprous, as white as snow. Then Aaron turned towards Miriam, and there she was, a leper." You know, and if you look at this, this was essentially the ultimate physical punishment that you could give to somebody during this day. Right? At the time, leprosy was always fatal. But it wasn't fatal in a way that you would die instantly. No, you would die isolated from your people. You would die in poverty and despair as you would slowly be eaten away by this bacteria that caused your skin to rot, right? And at the time, there wasn't any worse disease. We see how much God focuses on leprosy in the Bible. And so this was, you know, a very serious thing. He took it very seriously, and the punishment he meted out was, you know, almost as bad as it could get. You know, I don't think physically at this time there's much worse that you could do to somebody. And so it goes on in verse 12 or verse 11. It says, "So Aaron said to Moses, 'Oh my Lord, please do not lay this sin on us in which we have done foolishly and which we have sinned.'" All right. So Aaron quickly realizes what he's done, what they've done, and the seriousness of it. And it goes on, "Please do not let her be as a dead one," right? Because that's what people would consider someone had leprosy, is that they were already dead. It hadn't happened yet, but they were as good as dead, "whose flesh is half consumed when he comes out of his mother's womb." And so verse 13, notice Moses' response, right? What would be our response? Yeah, you know, not maybe quite so serious, but what would be our response, or what was our response as a child if we got in a squabble with our brother and sister and our parents came in and stopped it? Would we have, you know, responded like this, or we've been like, yeah, now they're getting in trouble, they're getting what they deserve? No, we see Moses says, "So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, 'Please heal her, O God, I pray.' And then the Lord said to Moses, 'If her father had but spit in her face, would she not have been shamed 7 days? Let her be shut out of the camp 7 days, and afterwards she may be received again.' So Miriam was shut out of the camp 7 days, and the people did not journey till Miriam was brought in again. And afterwards the people moved on into a different place." You know, as we read this story, there's many things that we can learn. But what I want to focus on in this message is to go back to verse 3 and see what God is telling us about Moses and what we can learn from many of his other actions. In Numbers 12, verse 3, it says, and I'll read out of the King James Version this time. It says, "Now the man Moses was very meek above all men which were upon the face of the earth." You know, think about this statement from God here. You know, this is God recording of Moses. Now, whether Moses wrote it or some speculated maybe Joshua or someone else wrote this down, you know, it doesn't really matter, because this is God's words. And God here is saying that Moses was meek to a point beyond any other person that was on the face of the earth. You know, and as we'll see, it doesn't go beyond that. But as we look at Moses' life, you know, I think it's possible that Moses might have been, you know, you could say the second meekest man in the world of all times, right? Of course, behind Jesus Christ. But his meekness was unparalleled, as we'll see. But the amazing thing is that just in this story, we see immediately Moses' meekness coming out, right? Because as we'll see, one of the signs of meekness is that you don't respond harshly. You don't respond in a critical way, even when you've been hurt. And what did Moses do? I mean, they had criticized him to the point where God handed out a punishment to Miriam of leprosy. So you can only imagine what they had been saying about him. But what did he do? Did he respond in kind? Was he happy that they got what they deserved? And of course, they got what they deserved because God directly meted out that punishment. You know, no, he immediately went to God and said, forgive them, heal her. You know, don't account this to sin on their behalf. And so you see this meekness almost immediately. But meekness is often a misunderstood word, a misunderstood virtue, a misunderstood attitude. You know, it's often combined or thought of as weakness, right? We often think of somebody who's meek as somebody who's shy, timid, doesn't really put themselves forth out there. You know, humble, of course, is a word, but when we think of meekness, especially in the modern day sense, it's not necessarily something that's viewed as a strength, as a virtue, something you should go after. But we see that it clearly is. The Hebrew word here that's translated as meek is anav. It's H3065, and it means depressed in mind, gentle or circumstances, humble, lowly, meek, poor. You know, something like that. And when we look at, you know, the Oxford Dictionary, so the dictionary or the definition today, it's quiet, gentle, or easily imposed on, submissive. But was that Moses? Right? This is a man who was, when he died, you know, at 120 years old, his eyes weren't dimmed. This is a man that was a prince of Egypt. And if we believe some of the historical records from Josephus and others, he was a conqueror of Ethiopia. So such a great conqueror that they were impressed with his physical courage, his personal courage. Here was a man who, you know, was not someone who just kind of meekly sat around and prayed. No, he was a shepherd, 40 years in the wilderness, and he was in the mountains, you know, in the wilderness. He was a robust man. And we see other places where he was not physically weak. He wasn't even necessarily timid or other things, even though we'll see some of that. But this is not what meekness really is. We'll look at some of the dictionaries around the Bible that talk about it. So I'll read from the Easton Bible Dictionary what it says about meekness. It says, calm, temper of mind. Right? So he was calm. He had a calm temper about him, not easily provoked. And of course, we saw that, right? That God was provoked on his behalf, but he wasn't provoked. Webster's dictionary from 1828, so one of the older dictionaries that kind of paralleled a lot of the biblical usage of the word, its definition of meek is mild of temper, soft, gentle, not easily provoked or irritated, yielding, giving to forbearance under injury. Right, again, something that we saw from Moses. It says, appropriately humble. You know, when you think about humble, you think of it almost standalone. But here it's saying, appropriately humble. You know, it's not necessarily that you think nothing of yourself, but you think appropriately of yourself in relation to others, in relation to God. And that appropriateness, I think, is an important part of it. It says, submissive to the divine will, not proud, self-sufficient, not peevish or apt to complain of divine interventions. And then Bauer's lexicon says, meekness is when a person is not being overly impressed by a sense of one's own self-importance, gentle, humble, considerate. know, these are the words where, if you look at the biblical usage of meekness, this is what is God, you know, what God is trying to get across with this word. And this is what he was saying Moses was like. He wasn't physically weak. He wasn't necessarily shy or timid. No, he was someone who was considerate. He was someone that even when some harm was done to him, he wasn't quick to retaliate. He didn't have a quick temper. He was appropriately humble. He knew what he had done. He knew, you know, if he was a conqueror of Egypt, that he might have a sound military mind. He knew he was able to, you know, shepherd sheep in the wilderness. He knew he was able to go back and with God's power and ability to help get the Israelites out of slavery. He knew everything he had done, but he was still appropriately humble in all of these cases because, as we'll see, he knew where all of this came from. So, you know, think about Moses and just this one example about his brother and sister complaining against him. You know, instead of hitting right back, instead of being puffed up and said, "Do you know that God speaks to me face to face? I don't think he's ever talked to you face to face. Have you seen his form?" You know, did he say any of those things? Now, God certainly did. But this is, you know, a big part of meekness. Moses let God respond. He knew he didn't have to. He knew that God in his time and place would respond. And in this case, God immediately interceded, right? He heard what they said and immediately interceded and called out. You know, the Bible has much to say about meekness. Of course, you know, if we think about Galatians 5:23 and the fruits of the Spirit, right? It's translated as gentleness in the New King James Version, but the root of the word, or the Greek word that Paul uses, is meekness. So meekness is one of the fruits of God's Spirit. It's one of those things that we are to produce, that we are to grow in. If you look at other examples of showing and displaying meekness, you know, as I've talked about, it's manifested really in two ways, because the way you display meekness to God is slightly different than how you display meekness to mankind. And so if you think about it, in the relation to God, how you show meekness to God is you're yielding, you're teachable, you're responsible, or you're responsive to God, his ways, his teaching, his words, his individual plan for you, right? That, as we'll see, as many of you know, in Moses' life, you know, Moses had an interesting plan laid out for him by God. But he never complained about it. He never questioned, except for just a few times, what God had in mind for him. He went along with God. He trusted God. So that, as we think about meekness towards God, it's this approach, you know, not complaining, not questioning what God is doing in our lives, but looking for the bigger plan, looking for the bigger purpose that he has in mind. And in our relations to each other, to other humans, other men and women, it's manifested as being humble, being gentle, being respectful. Right? And think about these things. It's, you know, not necessarily something that is maybe the most sought after character trait today, or something that many people do. But this is what God is calling us to be humble, to be gentle, respectful, slow to respond even when there's hurt involved. You know, just as we saw with Moses, it's not paying back somebody we think, you know, what they should do, or we paying back what they think they should have or what they deserve, but it's letting God take over. Let God decide what is the right thing. And again, if you think about this example of Moses, even when you're hurt, it's about interceding on their behalf, right? How many times have you been hurt by somebody, and instead of going to God and asking him to, you know, mete out some judgment on them, you go and say, "God, just, you know, don't do it. Don't worry about it. You know, they didn't know what they were doing, or they were just in the wrong frame of mind, or whatever." But this is what Moses did. And as we'll see, it's something he did time and time and time again. Even when, you know, complaints and criticisms were directed directly at him, he never responded in kind, except for one time, which we'll look at the end. And if we see, you know, beyond Christ and David, Paul, Peter, James, the prophets, many others talked about meekness and how fundamental developing meekness is to our Christian walk and even our national character. We'll turn here to Zephaniah. This is, I think, an interesting look on what God will ultimately do around meekness. So if we turn to Zephaniah, we'll begin in chapter 3, verse 1. You know, in this book, the prophet Zephaniah is proclaiming the coming judgment on Israel and their enemies, right? So no respecter of persons, that all those who oppose God are going to be meted out judgment. And it also talks about the coming day of the Lord. Well, here in chapter 3, it begins in verse 1, and it continues on with this judgment that God will hand out. So Zephaniah 3, verse 1, it says, "Woe to her who is rebellious and polluted, to the oppressing city. She has not obeyed my voice. She has not received correction. She has not trusted in the Lord. She has not drawn near to her God." And keep those things in mind, because as we'll look, basically God's just saying, if you're doing these things, you're not meek. But I will build, or I will produce, a meek people. And then in Zephaniah chapter verse 3, it says, "Her princes in her midst are roaring lions. Her judges are evening wolves that leave not a bone till morning." You know, how much does that sound like our nation today? Dropping down to verse 5, we see that God, though, is still present. Even in this, it says in verse 5, it says, "The Lord is righteous in our midst." So even in all these troubles, all these bad things, all these ways in which the nation of Israel is going away from God, he's still there, righteous in our midst. And he will do no unrighteousness. Every morning he brings his justice to light. He never fails. But the unjust knows no shame. And it goes on and talks about the judgment God will hand out, destroying fortresses, making streets desolate, destroying cities. But then in verse 9, it starts to talk about the restoration of all people. And then in verse 11, it says, this is Zephaniah 3, verse 11, says, "In that day you shall not be shamed for any of your deeds in which you transgress against me. For then I will take away from your midst those who rejoice in your pride, and you shall no longer be haughty in my holy mountain." And then look at what verse 12 says. So, you know, think, he's handing out this judgment, judgment that he's handing out on Israel, which is very harsh and very severe. But what does it produce in the end? It says, "I will leave in your midst a meek and a humble people." Right? God is going to bring the people of Israel, the nation of Israel, down low with these great punishments. But what he's going to leave in the midst, what all of these things are for, what they're all moving towards, is that he's going to have now a meek and a humble people. And it goes on and says, "And they shall trust in the name of the Lord." You know, we see here that meekness and humility are opposed to things like transgression, pride, haughtiness, right? Rebelliousness. These are in opposition, but he says through this punishment, through this judgment, that what he's going to build, what he's going to leave behind, is a meek and humble people. You know, God knows that to develop, you know, or sorry, God knows how to develop a meek and humble people. You know, he has no doubt on how it's done. But unfortunately for most, what it means is he has to bring you down low, that you think very highly of yourself in many different regards. And then to produce a meek and humble people, or a meek and humble person out of that, you have to bring them low. You have to, unfortunately, met out this judgment, this justice that God talks about here. You know, if we think about it, even Moses, and again, we don't know explicitly, but it's likely, based off the story of Moses, that God builds the meekness in Moses through his 40 years in the wilderness, right? He had been a prince of Egypt. What had he thought about himself when he conquered Ethiopia? I'm sure he thought he was pretty good, you know, pretty kind of hot stuff. And, you know, if the Ten Commandments movie is to believe, he might have been, you know, in line to succeed the Pharaoh. But what happens? He gets, you know, punished. He gets exiled out of Egypt, and he goes into the wilderness. And for 40 years, he's a lowly shepherd. He's out in the mountains shepherding these sheep. So he's no longer this prince of Egypt, but he's this shepherd out in the wilderness. And so again, you know, maybe he had some meekness before, but we know through how God builds meekness in other people that it's likely this 40-year period in the wilderness that Moses builds this meekness to such a point that he becomes the meekest man on earth. And imagine that, and what God can do, or what God did for Moses, and what God can do for you and I, and what he says he'll do for Israel in the end time. And of course, God will do the same with you and I. You know, he will bring us low if he has to build our meekness. But the thing that we have that Moses didn't is we have the Holy Spirit working in us today. You know, he had the Holy Spirit at some point. We don't know exactly when he was given it, but and of course the Spirit was working with him. But brethren, you and I have the Holy Spirit today. And if we work with it, if we allow it to work within us, we don't have to go through the same process of being brought down low. Now, as we see, even God's people, many of them will have to be brought down low to build this meek and humble character. But we don't have to. It's something that we can bypass by using God's Holy Spirit. Moving on from this national character that we saw in Zephaniah, you know, personally, meekness is a core character trait that we all have to grow in. Paul talks about meekness and its importance in Colossians 3, verse 12. It says, "Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved," and then it tells some character traits that you're to put on. Put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering. So this is something, you know, again, Paul is making clear we don't naturally have. It's not something that's well aligned with our human nature. It's something that we have to put on, that we have to go to God and ask for him to develop it in us. And it goes on, it says, "Bearing with one another and forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do." Again, think about how much this is aligned to the story of Moses, right? If anyone has a complaint against you, even as Christ forgave you, you also must do. You know, Moses immediately forgave them. But Moses went even beyond forgiving them. He interceded for them with God. And of course, meekness, you know, the ultimate example of meekness is Christ himself. And we see many examples. You know, maybe the one that might jump out to you the most is John 13:5, right? Where during Passover, Jesus humbled himself by washing the feet of the disciples, even Judas Iscariot, who he knew was going to betray him. He knew Judas was going to betray him, and yet he still washed his feet. You know, in some ways, that's one of the ultimate signs of meekness that Christ displayed. But as I said, there was many times. And Christ, you know, makes clear that a very core part of him was meekness. We read in Matthew 11:29, it says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest unto your souls." That's from the New King or the King James Version. But he's saying, "I'm meek," a very part of me. And it might seem odd to us to have somebody declare themselves meek. I like to tease my kids, you know, when they kind of do or say something, and I'm like, "Oh, you're very humble, aren't you?" And, you know, they're all like, "Yes, yes." And it's almost a sure sign that they're not humble if they talk about their humility. But here Christ does, right? He says, I'm a meek person. And that's where, you know, when you look at true godly meekness, it is something you can actually say about yourself. Now, of course, you probably should let other people say it about you. Let God say it about you. Let your brothers and sisters say it about you. But it's something that you can say about yourself, because it's not just a state of mind. It's how you act towards other people. You can go and look, you know, time and time again, are you doing the meek thing or are you not doing the meek thing? So as we see that Christ himself is telling us how important it is to be meek. But here he says that when you are meek, when you're lowly in heart, the burdens that you bear are going to be lighter. You know, he doesn't say that everything is going to be perfect. He doesn't say everything's necessarily going to be easy. He doesn't say that nothing bad or hard will happen to you. All he's saying is that when you're meek, when you're lowly of spirit, the things that you have to bear, the things that are hard, the things that are not easy, will be lighter, will be not so heavy to bear. And so that is, you know, one of the key things that we think about as we think about meekness, is that it helps you bear the burdens of this life and make them lighter than what they would otherwise be if you were high in, you know, instead of being lowly of spirit, if you were high of spirit, if you had a high opinion of what you think you should be or what station you should have in life, those things will make it hard to bear when God decides where you'll go in this life. But when you're meek, when you're humble, when you're lowly of spirit, those things become light because you know where they're coming from. You know what God is doing for you. And of course, this isn't the only value or the only promise that God gives to those who are meek. He actually gives a number of things that he says will come with meekness. So a number of rewards where if you develop meekness, if you look to him to develop meekness within yourself, you can be guaranteed of these rewards. I'll just read a few or kind of summarize them and give you the scriptures for them. The first is Psalms 22:26. It says, "The meek shall eat and be satisfied." Now again, notice what it doesn't say. It doesn't say you'll be given everything you want. It doesn't say you'll be given over an abundance. Here it doesn't even say, you know, your cup will runneth over and these kind of things. No, it just says you'll eat, God will take care of you, and then you'll be satisfied with what God gives you. Maybe it's exactly what you want, maybe it's not, but whatever God gives you, you'll be satisfied with if you're meek. Another one in Psalms 25:8-10, it says, "The meek will he guide in judgment, and the meek he will teach his ways." You know, think about that. God is saying if you're meek, he's going to personally guide you, personally teach you his ways. And if we think about it, you know, it's even true of parents or teachers, right? Do you want to teach somebody who's constantly arguing with you, constantly back-talking you, constantly disagreeing with you, or even worse, just going and doing the opposite of what you taught them? Yeah, that's not exactly the, you know, your preferred student. Who do you want to teach? You want to teach someone who's teachable, who wants to hear, who knows they need to be taught. And this is what, of course, meekness is at its very core. Another one, in Isaiah 29:19, it says, "The humble," or the meek, "also shall increase their joy in the Lord." So imagine that. If you're meek, your joy is going to increase. Another one, that you'll be protected from God's anger. This is Zephaniah 2:3. It says, "Seek the Lord, all you meek of the earth, who have upheld his justice. Seek righteousness, seek humility. It may be that you will be hidden in the day of the Lord's anger." You'll be hidden from God's wrath. You know, if you think about who are those people of the church who are going to be protected in the end times, Zephaniah here is saying one of the requirements is going to be that you're meek, that you've already gone through this process to build meekness as part of your character. Because, you know, if you think about that end time and people that won't be protected, part of the things that they will be building is meekness. You know, they will be brought down low, but they'll be brought down low so that ultimately they can be in God's kingdom. And of course, God knows what's best. Another one is, you know, this one is probably very familiar, is inheritance of the earth, right? Matthew 5:5, one of the Beatitudes. But, you know, it's interesting that David actually said this first in the Old Testament. Here in Psalms 37:11, it says, "But the meek shall inherit the earth and shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace." Right? And of course, Christ told David first, and then Christ told everyone again. But, you know, this was something the Jews should have known. If you think about this particular beatitude, it wasn't something new. They had already been told what kind of character trait they should be building, which was meekness, if they wanted to inherit the earth. And then ultimately, the last one is that in Psalms 149:4, it says, and this will read from the King James Version, "For the Lord takes pleasure in his people, he will beautify the meek with salvation." that one of the things that he will give to those who are meek is salvation. So think about these great blessings associated with meekness, satisfaction, being taught and led personally by God, increasing joy, protection from God's anger, inheritance of the earth, and eternal salvation. You know, that's how powerful meekness is. Again, it's not the only attitude that we have to work on. We have many others, but it is a very powerful attitude, a very powerful fruit that we are to grow in. Now let's go back to Moses, because I want to finish the story of Moses and look at Moses' life and a few of the examples to help us understand how meek Moses was. Because I think as we look, and I'm only going to use a few of the stories, but when you look at Moses, it's amazing how meek he is. So we saw in Numbers 12 was one example of Moses' meekness, but it wasn't something that just appeared, right? It wasn't something that just happened. Numbers 11, he developed meekness and now he was good to go. You know, we see it even first starting as far back as Exodus 3. It says, and this, as we know, is the story of the burning bush. And again, you know, God doesn't tell us for sure, but the timing of this story seems to indicate it is this period in the wilderness where Moses really developed meekness. So this is the story of the burning bush. And as we read in Exodus 3, 6 through 10, God talks to Moses about who he is, demonstrating his power, his authority, and what God is calling Moses to do, which is to go free the people of Israel, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. And in verse 11, we read, it says in Exodus 3, verse 11, "But Moses said to God, 'Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?'" You know, think about this. Again, as I said, like, we know Moses had been a prince of Egypt. And, you know, as I said, if Josephus is to be believed, Moses was a mighty general, conquering nations. And at the time, the Ethiopians were likely the second largest empire, the second largest kingdom behind Egypt. So this wasn't like it was a small country that he had conquered. He had, you know, he'd gone in and conquered one of the major world powers. And based off of, you know, the stories of Josephus and others, it was with great personal courage that he'd conquered him. Like, he had been the major factor in then conquering Ethiopia. So if you think about it, you know, who was he that he should go into Pharaoh and say, "Let the children of Israel out, children of Israel go"? You know, he'd been a conquering general. He had been a prince of Egypt. You know, he, you know, maybe even knew the Pharaoh or likely knew the Pharaoh. So there was a lot to recommend that he would be the right person. But all those things were in his mind, and he still didn't think he was a person to go do it. Right? And of course, this was 40 years in the wilderness that he'd been. He'd been brought down low, right? He might have said, "Well, 40 years ago, I would have been that right person. I would have gone in, I'd have taken my sword, we would have armed the children of Israel, and we would have fought our way out." But after he'd been in the wilderness 40 years, he responds to God and says, "Who am I? Who am I that you would pick me to go?" And when I read this part of the story, it's interesting because I also think about King Saul, right? The first king of Israel. You know, do you remember when he was selected to be king? What did he do? Something maybe fairly similar. He had been anointed by Samuel to be king, so he knew he was going to be king. And then Samuel goes out and he does the lottery to choose who should be king, and Saul is chosen. But what does he do? And you remember, Saul was a big, impressive man. And, you know, it talks about how much he looked like a king. He was a head above all the other Israelites. But he goes, hides in the equipment, hides in the stuff, right? And on the surface, this might be fairly similar to the response that we see from Moses, right? In some ways, both of them are saying, you know, who are we? Even though there's some physical characteristics that might suggest that they should be in the position God's suggesting. But of course, what we know is over the course of Moses' life, we see what he was displaying was humility, meekness. But we see what Saul was displaying was more like a false humility, more of a shyness, more of a timidness But that once he was in power, once he that timidness went away, once the shyness went away, he didn't have that meekness to fall back on. And what did he do? He then thought of himself more highly than he should have. And so how we respond in one particular circumstance isn't always going to show us whether we're meek or whether we're shy and timid. But over our lifetimes, we can see it. Over time and time again, different circumstances. And especially when we're, you know, so to say, brought high. When we're in a place of authority, a place of power, that's where our meekness will really be tested to see if it's true meekness. And of course, we all are going to be sons of the Most High. We're going to be in an elevated place. And God can't have it be where we're in this elevated place where we're the bride of Christ, where we're, you know, co-inheritors with Jesus Christ of the kingdom. And then we get in this place and now all of a sudden our meekness isn't really meekness. It was just timidity or shyness. And we become like Saul. And so that is why we have to prove our meekness to God today. But going back to this story of Moses and God and the burning bush, we see, you know, Moses asked, who am I? Who am I that I should go? And we see how God responds in verse 12. This is Exodus 3, verse 12. So he, being God, said, I will certainly be with you. You know, and there's some more questioning from Moses, who's, you know, not fully believing, not fully comfortable that he's been chosen by God, even to the point, of course, where God has to have Aaron be the mouthpiece of Moses because, you know, he had a stutter or some other thing that he wasn't comfortable in speaking. But as I look at Moses' life, I wonder if this verse 12 is a very pivotal point for Moses. And if Moses often thought back on this promise that he'd gotten from God. And as we'll see, Moses continuously makes God live up to this promise. He forces God to live up to this promise, which is very important. And a critical part of Moses' meekness is this, is that he relies on God to get him out of tough spots, even when he is in places of power. Dropping down to chapter 5, after Moses and Aaron convince the Israelites that they're being saved by God, you know, Moses and Aaron, you know, they first convince the Israelites, and then they go to Pharaoh and they say, you know, we want you to let the Israelites go out to have a feast to the Lord. Not even going away, just, you know, let us go out and worship God. But what does Pharaoh say in chapter 5, verse 2? Notice how different Pharaoh responds from what Moses responded. And so Exodus 5, verse 2, it says, and Moses said, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? You know, how different, how opposite it is from how Moses responded to God. You know, Moses said, who am I that you would pick me for this thing? Moses essentially says the opposite. He says, do you know how great I am? Do you know how powerful I am? And I know nothing about this God. Why should I think he's more powerful than me because I'm the mighty Pharaoh, right? I think of myself as a god. You know, very different attitude. Meekness as opposed to haughtiness and arrogance. And Pharaoh goes on and says that, you know, for this, the children of Israel will no longer have straw to make bricks, but will need to make as many bricks as they had before, giving them even more work to do. And then Moses goes back after hearing this to God and says, And you could see that even this meekness is having to be built even now because it's not fully there. Moses in Exodus 5 verse 22, so Moses returns to the Lord and says, Lord, why have you brought trouble on this people? Why is it that you sent me? He's saying, you know, why did you just do this? You went to all this trouble and now you're just giving more work to the Israelites? But God, of course, responds in Exodus 6 verse 1. He says, then the Lord said to Moses, now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand he will let them go, and with a strong hand he will drive them out of his land. So saying that he, the Lord, is with Moses, just like he had said originally, that he's going to be there with him and he's going to deliver on that promise. God, of course, goes on and tells Moses, you know, what to go say to the Israelites. And Moses faithfully goes and tells what God had told him to do. And we see this time and time again during this period of deliverance that God tells Moses to go say something and Moses faithfully goes and tells either Pharaoh or the children of Israel exactly what God had said to Moses. And so he begins to build this confidence in God. He begins to build this habit that when he's in a tough spot, he doesn't look for ways to do it himself. He looks for how God is going to deliver him, how God is going to take him through. And there's so many examples of this, but I want to look at four in particular as I close up, because when you think about this, you know, Moses now, and these four examples were once they were in the wilderness. So here Moses is, you know, gone through, he's delivered, you know, God, but, you know, through him, God delivered the Israelites out of Egypt. He'd seen the parting of the Red Sea. He had seen miracles. He had seen God. God was talking face to face to him. So this was, you know, a period of time after all of this that, and if you think about it, he was the ruler of a nation, right? He wasn't a king per se, but he was in charge of a nation. He, you know, the equivalent of a president or a prime minister today. And so he was in a position of authority. He could tell the nation what to do. And they would, you know, not have to do it. They could always fight back. And we know the grumbling and that kind of stuff. But he was in charge. You know, he didn't necessarily have to rely on God's authority. But we see in these examples that even when he was in this position of elevated authority, he never forgot where his true power lied, where his true reliance was. The first I want to pick up in Numbers 14, verse 5. Numbers 14 talks about where the children of Israel rebel against God and they want to pick a new leader and go back to Egypt. And what was Moses' response? In Numbers 14, 5, it says, "Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel." Could you imagine this? That he was the leader of the people. He was in charge. And what did he did when they complained against him? Did he rise up and say, "Do you know who I am?" Did he, you know, command those that were faithful to him to go and kill those who were complaining and wanted to rebel? No, he fell on his face in front of them. You know, that would be almost it would be one of those things that I think would be so dramatic that it would be hard to be part of that, I think. Like, I don't know, personally, I think I would just be stunned. Like, what just happened here? Like, why did this man in authority fall down on his face? But this is what Moses did in front of all of them. I mean, could you imagine a president, a CEO, you know, someone in that kind of authority falling down on their face before the whole company, the whole country? You know, imagine a CEO who's at their, you know, yearly or their annual investor conference and people start disagreeing with his strategy and, you know, saying how bad of a CEO he is, and he just falls on his face. What would they do? He would become a laughingstock, right? What about a president who was in a debate and he fell on his face? This is what Moses did. You know, this was not something that was normal, not something that most people would do. But then let's, you know, and then again, the interesting thing, so here in Numbers 14, you know, they're rebelling against God. They want to pick a new leader. They're angry with Moses. But what does Moses do? Just like when Miriam and Aaron complained against him, we see here in Numbers 14, 13 through 19, he intercedes for those who want to replace him. They hate him as a leader, and he says, "God, don't destroy him." Not only that, he's pretty creative in how he gets God not to destroy him, going pretty far. You know, I would say pretty confident in his relationship with God. You know, he doesn't just say, "Hey, God, you know, can you please not destroy him?" He's saying, "Look, God, this isn't in your best interest." Again, this isn't a meek, a timid person. This is a meek person. This isn't a timid, shy person. This is someone who has strength. This is someone who knows where they stand, right? What did I say earlier? He had the appropriate level of humility. He knew his relationship with God. He knew that he had a relationship with God in such a way that he could push God a little bit, could say, God, this isn't really who you are. This isn't really in your best interest. Again, not shy, not timid, not weak, very strong and very meek. The next example is in number 16, which talks about Korah's rebellion. Here, Korah comes with many of the leaders of Israel, and they rise up against Moses, again, complaining about Moses. If you think about, again, Moses being the most humble or the most meek man in the world, people didn't like him. People weren't happy with his authority in many cases. People didn't like to be underneath this meek man. And so we see here they're complaining about Moses taking on too much responsibility, but really they're talking about authority. And again, how does Moses respond? Here in Numbers 16, verse 4, it says, "So when Moses heard it, he fell on his face." Now, what is he doing when he falls on his face? Was this him being clumsy? Was this him being klutzy? No, he was falling on his face, praying to God, asking him to remember the promise that he had made to Moses to always be with him. And what had God said? "I certainly will be with you." And again, he's asking God to prove it. Prove that you're going to certainly be with me. Do you think that as he fell on his face, he was thinking that? He was thinking, "God, I certainly need you with me right now. Right now is a good time to remember the promise that you made to me." And again, this is the meekness of Moses. There's no weakness here. It even tells in verse 15 that Moses became angry with him. So here we're seeing meekness and anger being mixed together. Right? So it's not weakness. It's this appropriate humility. He knew where he was at. He knew how to respond. And his first response was always, before he even got angry, his first response was to fall on his face and pray to God, no matter who was there, no matter who was watching. And then the same story about the rebellion of Korah, the Lord then gets angry. He's like, again, they should have learned because of Miriam and Aaron. They should have learned from the first rebellion. And now, it's just not going to, I'm not going to tolerate it anymore. And so we see here in Numbers 16, verse 20, it says, "And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a minute." He's going to consume all the nation of Israel. It says, look again in verse 22, what did they do? "Then they fell on their faces." Time and time again, Moses, when he was in a hard spot, he fell on his face. Didn't matter where he was at, who was around him, he fell on his face and he prayed to God. And he says, they fell on their faces and said, "O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin and you be angry with all the congregation?" Again, they're pushing God. They're saying, "God, I don't think you thought this through. There's no, there's no weakness here." A weak person would just say, "God, whatever you think is right, whatever you think is just." No, they thought through the situation. They knew God's character. They knew how God would respond. And if God had decided to consume the congregation, he would have been righteous in doing it. But they knew that wasn't really his deepest trait. His deepest trait was tender mercies, was love, was forgiveness. Right? He wouldn't tolerate sin, but he could do it a different way. And they push God to think about it differently. And so here, again, there's no weakness. So moving on in the story, God has now swallowed up just those that sinned. So Korah and the leaders that had sinned. And then what does the congregation do? They didn't say, "Thank you for saving us from being consumed by God." They complained that Moses had killed Korah and the people. So again, think of it. The people of Israel are complaining not against God. They're complaining against Moses who had just saved them. But what does the God say? So again, Numbers 16, verse 44, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, get away from the congregation." Now, the second time he has said this, "that I may consume them in a moment." And what do they do? I'm sure you can guess by now. They fell on their faces. And Moses then has Aaron run through the congregation with a censer to prevent a plague. This plague had already consumed 14,000 people, had killed 14,000 people. But Moses and Aaron, you know, prevented this from consuming the whole nation of Israel. And you see here, Moses is the one who's ordering Aaron to run through the congregation. He could have said, Aaron, you know, just stand there and let's see what God decides. But again, he doesn't. He intercedes for the people who had just been complaining about him after he had just saved them, after they just complained about him. You know, if you think about long-suffering, this story of Korah is a great example of someone who is long-suffering. And again, this is an amazing example of meekness, both towards God and man. Right? He is here, you know, talking with God, and he is kind of pushing God on what to do, making sure God is really thinking through it. You know, and reading this, there's no doubt that the meekness of Moses was great, you know, greater than anyone at that time, and as I said before, maybe greater than anyone except for Christ himself. But there's more, right? One more, in Numbers 20, here again, the people are complaining, right? There's no water in the wilderness, even though God had provided it many times before, and the people are complaining. And so here in Numbers 20, verse 6, it says, "So Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and they," guess what? "Fell on their faces." Fell on their faces, crying to God, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. You know, and again, we can read over these stories, I think, pretty quickly and not think through what it really means. You know, not put it in the context that we might have. You know, Moses, as I said, was a leader of the nation. He had been a conquering general. He was not a weak man. He didn't have no power and authority in and of himself. He had it. But his first response was not to leverage his own power and authority. His first response was go to God, fall on his face, humble. I mean, how humbling would it be to fall on your face in front of a huge crowd of people, a huge crowd of people that should be looking to you as a leader but are complaining about you? This isn't showing how great Moses is, except for it is. But from our human perspective, it's not Moses showing how great he is. He's showing how deep the strength of character he had, how meek he was, and how willing he was to always go back to God and rely on God to carry through on his promise. You know, and if you think about, you know, in the history of our nation, think about our leaders. I, you know, as I thought about this, there was only one or two presidents. The two that kind of came to mind that I read similar stories of were George Washington, where several times during the Revolutionary War, he would go and pray to God. He would go and pray to God. But even he, the stories at least that I've read, he would go off away from his men. It's not that he was ashamed of it. It's not that he was, you know, per se shy about his faith in God. But when he needed to rely on God, when he needed that strength from God, he would go off. He didn't fall on his face in front of his own men and show how much he needed God. Again, nothing against George Washington. He's a great man and you know, from everything we know, a great believer in God and a great person who relied on God. But again, different level than Moses. Not quite there, not quite the same as Moses. And Abraham Lincoln, another one. You know, several stories, but nothing quite like that, where he time and time again would fall on his face in front of other people, showing how much he needed God, how much he relied on God. And of course, now it would be unheard of. But this meekness of Moses, brethren, is what we are called to build, what we are called to become like. You know, and kind of a one note of caution, as I'd mentioned earlier, you know, the meekness of man, though, can never compare to the meekness of God. You know, I find it interesting that we've read all these stories about Moses, right? How much he relied on God, how meek he was, how, you know, even God said he was the most meek man in the world at that time. But what was the one thing that prevented him from going into the promised land? The one recorded time when he wasn't meek before God. You know, here was the man who was the greatest, most meek, or the most meek man in the world. And what was the one thing that prevented him from seeing the promised land? It was the one time we're recorded that he didn't show meekness. This is in Numbers 20, verse 12. Here, it was right after the story that we'd read before, where, you know, Moses had fallen on his face with Aaron and God had water come out of the rock. And right after that, we read in Numbers 20, 10, verse 13, Moses strikes the rock. And it was a very different attitude that Moses showed here. This is in Numbers 20, verse 6. It says, so Moses and Aaron went, we saw in Numbers 20, verse 6, where they had the same situation and they had fallen on their face. But in this situation, Moses had said, we are going to bring water out of the rock. You know, you can imagine what God thought at that point. There's no we in this. You're not doing anything about bringing the water out of the rock. It's all me. But again, he didn't not bring water out of the rock. Moses had been faithful. He had shown his meekness. And so Moses, when he struck the rock and disobeyed God, God still made water go out of the rock. But we see what he then tells Moses and Aaron. In Numbers 20, verse 12, it says, then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel. See, they puffed themselves up. They put themselves on the same level as God just this once. Just this once that we read, they put themselves on the same level of God, saying, we're going to do this for you. And it says, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. And we don't see again after this that Moses becomes haughty and arrogant again. We don't see it happening again. It doesn't turn him bitter towards God, which it could have, right? Often would in this case. But Moses meekly took this correction. This thing that he'd been working towards for, you know, almost 40 years, he just took it and he said, I will abide by your command, God. Right? He didn't complain that the punishment was too great to bear, but he looked beyond that physical promise into the eternal spiritual promise that he knew would come at some point. So brethren, you know, as you've heard about the meekness of Moses, what did you take away? What did you think about? For me, when I read this story, when I thought about this story in this way, and as I said, I've done it for many years now, I think about two things. The first is I have a long way to go to match even Moses' meekness. I'm nowhere near where Moses was. And Moses, his meekness couldn't get him into the promised land. It was still far from the meekness that Jesus Christ had, the meekness that we are called to have. And so I see how far I have to go. The second is that, you know, even the best that a human can do, which is what God clearly told about Moses, that he was the most meek man in the world, that we will always fall short, even in our greatest strengths, and that ultimately we do need the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, our Savior, to cover our sins. But this is meekness at its core, right? To know and understand our place in relation to God, that we can't ever go and make eternal life happen for ourselves, that we have to rely on God. That doesn't prevent us from working and building character. It doesn't prevent us from trying to achieve the level of meekness that Moses had, or even better, that Jesus had. But it does mean that we have to know our place in relation to God, that compared to God, we are nothing. And compared to each other, when we compared to God, we're all nothing. And so, brethren, we need to learn this lesson of meekness that Moses has shared with us.